Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
All right, welcome back to the Disruption Zone. And we've got Congressman Thomas Massey back on. We're going to talk about food shortages today. Welcome back, Congressman Massey. How are you?
I'm doing well, Leland. I'm getting tired of being right all the time, though.
I'm getting tired of you being right and people not listening to you. Before we get into that, though, we were just talking about concealed carry. It's a fun topic for me. Mm-hmm. And so what is your favorite concealed carry? What's the weapon of choice that you like to carry when you're carrying concealed?
Well, when I have the room to carry it without printing, I like to carry a Kimber 45 and ultra carry.
Cool.
The trigger on it is so nice.
Yeah.
And then
it's a smooth gun.
Yeah, in the summer, or when it's you have fewer options, I carry a SIG 230.
Okay.
Which is a 380 caliber, and they've updated it to the SIG 232 now.
Yeah.
But it looks like a little Walther PPK. It's very ergonomic. A lot of people might frown on it because of the caliber, and also because it's a little bit bigger than most 380s, but I can't hold a Ruger LCP.
Yeah.
And the sights, I know they've updated the Rugers and the sights are better and the trigger is better, but I like my SIG.
I hate the LCP. I have one. And in fact, mine is, I'd say it's like probably 10 years old. So it's, I keep it. I've bought two guns. This is kind of funny. I've actually bought two firearms since to replace it, and I never could. I was like, well, I'll trade this in, get credit on it at the store. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why? It's a gun. It's a firearm. Why would I ever get rid of any firearm at all? So I've kept it, and it just comes in handy, like you said, like when you need something really small, you don't want to print. I've got a neat little like holster that I can like – it's not really a holster. It's more like a pocket.
Yeah.
That you can put inside a pocket. So if I have to wear like a suit, and my wife likes me to wear those stupid European suits that are a little closer cut, mm-hmm. So having that little folder that I can put it in, no one knows I'm carrying it. So, but my favorite is the S&P N40. I just love that gun. It's a real great shooting gun. I know some people are like, I'd rather have a Glock or whatever. I don't know how you can carry a Glock and not have somebody see it.
Yeah, I don't know either. By the way, I won a gun at a Friends of NRA dinner.
Sweet.
And for like $20, it's a Kimber 9mm, Micro 9, I think it's called.
Okay.
And I haven't had a chance to really try it out. I was excited because I carry the Kimber Ultra Carry, the 45. And I wasn't that impressed, though, with this Micro 9. The trigger needs some work or something.
Yeah.
But I have one of those. I keep my Ruger LCP, too. I've got it's like a wallet holster.
Yes.
And I've worn out two of those. I'm on my third. It's a thick piece of leather, and eventually the leather becomes the shape of the gun.
Yeah. Mine's like, it started out black, and now it's like gray because it's right. About to be too thin. Guess I got to fix that. So awesome, man. All right. So you were on here with me about 3 weeks ago before anybody was talking about meat shortages. And I remember it was a conversation I wanted to have, but I didn't want to have because everybody, when you hear about a shortage right now, everybody goes and buys everything. But I felt like we needed to do it and we needed to air it because I wanted people who were paying attention to be aware. 3 weeks later, there's headlines everywhere about a potential meat shortage. And in fact, there's one particular headline, I tweeted it out yesterday and mentioned that you were coming on, and it was, we're 3 weeks away is what it said. We are 3 weeks away from no pork on the shelves. Go ahead and tell everybody you told them so, even though I know you don't like saying that right now.
I told you so. Yeah. And I think I said multiple times in the interview that I hope I'm wrong.
Right. You did. You did.
So I'm really not happy that I'm right, but here's what I saw, and here's when I first saw it. It was when they started pouring the milk out at the dairies, and the reason they had to do that it was a slightly different reason. Half their production was geared toward restaurants and half was geared toward the consumer. But there was a crimp in the pipeline between the farm and the consumer. And I realized that was going to happen with meat packers. And then the first one that had the issue with COVID-19 and then shut down their plant, I was like, oh, this is going to happen over and over and over.
Right.
And also, I've been studying this problem for a decade.
Yeah.
That our food supply is brittle, that most of the meat you buy in a supermarket goes through one of four meat packers. And two of those are owned by foreign investors. Smithfield is Chinese owned, and then there's one that's owned by Brazilians. So two of the four big meat packers and the four big ones control 80% of the supply. And some of these places process, for instance, 2,000 steers a day.
Yeah.
And when you shut one of those down, that's slowing down a pipeline. But here's the other problem you have. And a lot of people who've never been on a farm, they have a hard time understanding this. They say, why don't you just keep the animals alive until the factory opens back up?
Yeah. Actually, I was telling my dad about this the other day, and that was his question. And I said, you don't quite understand, but listen to this podcast. So go ahead.
Yeah, there's a pipeline of animals, right? When animals are born every week on the farm and animals leave the farm every week once they get to a certain weight. In fact, the breed of chicken that constitutes 95% of the chickens in grocery stores, those things, you butcher them like in 8 or 10 weeks. If you go to 12 weeks with or 16 weeks with one of those birds, they have heart attacks and broken legs. I've tried to raise them on my farm, and they're just not geared for longevity. They're geared to produce a giant breast.
Right.
And, you know, what consumers want. And it's,
they're geared to produce a giant breast and then topple over.
Yes. No, they are so lethargic.
Yeah.
Leland, they sit down while they eat. Like, they go to where they eat, and they just sit down.
Yeah.
Like, and they don't even sit down gracefully.
So they're like Americans.
And they're, like, sweating and overweight.
So and they're Americans.
And they're so easy to pluck, their feathers are falling out all the time anyways,
right,
without even plucking them. But anyway, and by the way, if a chicken gets to a certain age, it's almost impossible to pluck it.
Right.
Like, they go through this thing called molting, and you have to catch them in just the right stage of their life for them to be processed efficiently.
Right.
There's a similar thing with the hogs. They are not the breeds that are being raised are they're being raised because they're basically really meaty and fat by the time they're adolescents. You
right.
don't want one of these to get to adult age. Then it's not just that the meat gets tough, they break their legs and stuff. They get so heavy.
And by the way, just so people understand, most people listening know that you are a working farmer. In addition to a U.S. congressman. But I want people to understand the reason why you know all this stuff is because you have a farm and
yeah.
you do everything you're talking about being done here.
Thanks for bringing that up. I should have said that. I have 60 beef cattle. In fact, I took two steers, to a USDA processor yesterday. And I use USDA processors and I use non-USDA processors, depending on the consumer that I'm selling to. And so I do know a little bit about this. Now, hogs aren't the same thing as cattle, and so there are differences.
Yeah.
But with chickens, you've got like a one-week window to butcher them.
Right.
Okay. With hogs, you might expand that to a few weeks. Okay. And with steers, you could go a few months either way.
Right.
But by the way, when you get into cattle, if you take an animal that's older than 30 months to the processor, they have to process it differently than an animal that's younger than 30 months.
Why
and
is that?
That's because they've never found mad cow disease in a cow that's younger than 30 months.
Okay. So if we have a bunch of cows sitting around and they try to keep them alive.
Yeah.
Because that was when my dad was like, well, why don't you just hang on to them? And I was trying to explain the whole, like, well, there's only so much hay. You have so many animals on the farm. They're in a different life cycle. But so how do they have to butcher a cow that's older than differently?
Well, they have to take out the spinal column. They have to treat it. There's certain bone in cuts like T-bones and whatever you can't do because of the proximity to the spinal cord. And so they just treat it in a totally different way. And by the way, I've been at a facility arguing with them saying, no, my animal's less than 30 months old. And they're looking at the teeth and they're like, no, we think it's older than 30 months old because the teeth have worn down more.
Right.
But that's because I feed mine grass.
Right.
And they do a lot more chewing than if they're eating, you know.
Yours are healthier. Around. They just have their teeth are a little bit farther along.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So anyways, there's all these subtleties. And long story short, what happened at first, shortly after I spoke with you on the podcast, is they started destroying the eggs that were going to become hatchlings for the chicken industry. And then they ended up gassing some chickens, just killing them because they didn't have the processing capacity.
Wow.
And then when you get to the hogs, there's such a pipeline there, and it's been crimped at the processors that they started shooting and just wasting. In fact, the USDA is helping people figure out how to basically liquefy these animals, Jeez. How to render them, how to do something with them because they're not going into the meat supply. But they're shooting thousands of these per day now, killing thousands per day and
just
wasting them.
Did you had sent me, you texted me a picture and you were trying to verify it.
Yeah,
It's
verified.
You sent me a picture the other day of a massive pile of dead pigs. And you were like, I'm trying to verify if this is real. So you're saying that turned out to be real?
Yes.
God. And
wow. Steve King from Iowa witnessed over 1,000 hogs being euthanized on a farm the other day.
Yeah, wow. And I don't want to get like
– Well,
go ahead. Sorry.
Let me, just to finish the thread on hogs, and so you might think, okay, well – And the USDA and the president, everybody's trying to tell you, oh, don't worry, we got this under control. We're going to open these factories next week.
Yeah.
Well, here's the problem, Leland. The farmers can't afford the risk of the factory not being open, so they're causing the sows to abort the piglets.
Wow.
Now, what we're talking about here is a pipeline that's, you know, a few months long, and the farmers are already reacting by either not breeding back the sows or aborting the piglets that the sows would give birth to. So, you know, even though the media is reporting that this is all under control, these are long-term changes, and you've got also some farms that are going to go bankrupt in short order.
Right. I think people don't realize, because here's the other side of this, right? I mean, you're an independent farmer. And real quick, I just want to say this. I don't want to get political with this at all. But, you know, the way I look at animals, I love animals. I love bacon. I love a good pork chop. In fact, that's what I'm having for dinner tonight. But the fact that, like, you know, to me, they're part of a beautiful life cycle, right? Like, I love your farm. You raise a cow, you feed a cow, you treat a cow good, it lives a life low on stress, and then when it's done, I love the philosophy of the Virginia farm. I think you know who I'm talking about. I forget the name of it, but the one bad day. That's like the one bad day philosophy. And I know these animals are bred for us to eat, but it just feels like such an incredible waste to look at that pile of pigs and think, those are animals that God made. God made for us to be in dominion over them, yes. But he had a plan, you know, he has a plan for each life. And here we are, we're just shooting them in the head because of something avoidable, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But I'm not trying to get all touchy-feely hippie on you, but I just, to see an animal die for no reason, that bugs me. If it dies and ends up on my plate, I'm perfectly happy with that. But if it dies and lays there and rots, even if a stupid chicken has to wobble over and have a heart attack because it didn't fulfill its purpose, that bugs me.
It bugs me, too. You know, with my cattle, if I see one of them suffering, it pains me. Mm-hmm. And if a cow has a calf and then, let's say, a buzzard gets it or coyote gets it or something happens to the calf, when I look at that calf, I don't think, oh, I just lost $500. That's right. That thought doesn't go through my mind until like an hour later.
Right.
The first, and it does go through your mind, or else you're going to go broke.
Right.
But my first thought is, here's one of God's creatures suffering, or what did it suffer when it died? You know, how could I have prevented this? You know, you feel really bad for the animal. And when I was growing up, my dad took me hunting, and we never shot anything we weren't going to eat.
Yeah, my dad taught me that too.
There are things you could shoot that might be fun or challenging. You know, live animals, but I have no desire to shoot anything
right.
that I'm not going to eat. Unless, of course, it's a coyote that's going to eat something
right.
I'm going to eat. Right. There's one exception there.
Yes.
But it all involves not letting one of God's creatures go to waste.
Yeah.
And so when you see these pictures of thousands of dead animals stacked up, waiting to be disposed of, that are just going to go to waste, you know, my thought at first is not the economic impact. My first thought is, wow, that animal was wasted.
Yep.
And then my second thought is people are going to go hungry.
Right.
And then, you know, then somewhere in there you think that farmer's going to go broke.
Right.
But your first thought is sympathy. At least I think most farmers
yeah.
have sympathy for because they have a connection to the animal or they wouldn't raise him.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I want to go back now to the broke farmers, because this is another thing. I don't know if you've ever seen the documentary Dirty Money. We'll leave names out of this, but these like particular chicken farmers, the industrial chicken farmers, the guys that aren't doing it what you do, they're making a living raising chickens, okay? They are on the hook to these big companies in a big way. Like these big companies, you know, force them, they take loans mm-hmm. and then they have to pay the interest back on these loans if anything. And these are good people. They're just good people. A lot of them in Kentucky. They're good people making a living raising chickens. And if anything messes with that pipeline, they're so far in debt. That's what I'm worried about. I'm worried about the farmers that, because of this disruption, will never be – who knows what they're going to do? What are they going to do? I mean, some of them are so on the hook to the big industrial companies, and now the big industrial companies might have to shut down for a while. This is going to wreak havoc, I think, economically on those guys.
Yeah, and I'm not a lawyer, but the big companies that had contracts with these farmers are just breaking their contracts and
yeah.
calling it force majeure or whatever the word is.
Yeah, is that act of God or something?
Something like that. And so they're getting out of these contracts. I'll tell you, the cattle farmers are getting a double whammy here. And I witnessed this yesterday, by the way, when I dropped off two of my steers. I saw something interesting. I saw milk cows in line to be butchered
Whoa.
At the beef cattle facility. And these weren't like old decrepit milk cows that didn't. I mean, these are milk cows that you could go milk this cow. It had at least a gallon or two of milk right there in its milk sack. I mean, they're huge. They look different
wow.
than a beef cow. And what happens when you have these disruptions in the milk industry and that farmers can't get money for their milk, the first thing they do is, you know, they pour out the milk if nobody will buy it. But the second thing they do is they sell the milk cows into the beef supply. And if you can't make milk at any conversion ratio,
right.
then your reserve price for one of your milk cows is extremely low. It's much lower than the cost for a beef producer to produce a beef animal.
Okay.
And so what's happening now on the upstream, on the supply side, is that the dairy cattle are going into the beef cattle market and depressing the price of the beef cattle even further. Now, the consumer doesn't see or care. In fact, normally this would create cheaper beef prices
right.
in the supermarket, and the beef farmers would suffer because of the beef that's coming in from the dairy cows. But what's happening right now, there's a constraint on how much meat can get to the supermarket.
Right.
So the price is going to go up in the supermarket, but the beef farmer gets a double whammy. His animals aren't in demand because the dairy cattle can be butchered and become hamburgers.
So what's causing or what is going to cause the beef shortage, the pork shortage, the chicken shortage is because people at the plants that process these animals are getting sick with COVID or did a few weeks ago, and that disrupted the supply chain, and that's what led to these adjustments by farmers. Is that what's happening with milk production as well? The milk plant, there's milk plants that are shutting down and therefore not needing the milk deliveries?
No, so at the milk, at the dairy places, it's a different problem. Half of that milk supply was destined for restaurants, and a restaurant, you know, a big restaurant
okay.
or school lunches, they would receive the cheese in a tote, right?
Right.
in a box, in a lined box, instead of individually wrapped, you know, packages of cheese that are labeled with calories and labeled for resale.
Right.
Or the restaurants might get those little mini moos, you
right.
know, and they go through a lot of those and it adds up, but they don't sell those mini moos. Those particular ones aren't labeled individually. When somebody goes to the supermarket and buys milk, they want it in a blow molded gallon jug. Well, right. There's only so many blow molding machines, right? And so what they had to do is try to redirect some of that demand or some of that supply into the demand that had increased in grocery stores. So that was different than the problem. Now, the problem actually on the meat side, Leland, is when the restaurant demand went down.
Right.
The beef and pork piled up in frozen storage.
Okay.
And so there was actually some excess. So if you notice in the supermarket a week or two ago, the prices went down for a little while.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's why nobody believed me that the shortages were coming. They're like, no, meat prices are going in the other direction. Well, that's because there was this unused supply of meat that was going to go to the restaurants that got bottled up in frozen storage. And then if it's a quarter of an animal, instead of slicing it up and sending it in one package, they were working off that inventory and selling it into the grocery stores. It was a little bit easier to do that with beef and pork than it was with milk.
Right. But that's running out now. That backup frozen supply is starting to run out now. And at the same time, the processing plants are shutting down.
Right.
And it's causing a backup.
Right. Okay. And so you mentioned that one of the reasons for the processing plants shutting down is that employees are contracting COVID. They're actually contracting it at a much higher rate than say at other companies. And
why is that?
I don't know why it is. They say because the employees are not able to social distance the way the assembly lines are set up.
Right.
In the big facilities, not in the small processing, but in the big facilities, the ones that are shutting down. Also, maybe it's the temperature and the moisture in the environment. But it also may be that the folks that work in some of those factories live in the same housing. In close proximity. So yeah, I'm not sure what it is, but that's not the only reason they're shut down now, though, because one of the big reasons they shut down is they're worried about the liability.
Yes.
They're worried about lawsuits from the employees who aren't sick. If they did get sick in a courtroom, they would say, look, my employer told me to come to work. They knew that the incidence of a coronavirus were 10 times greater at our workplace.
Right.
There's reason to believe I contracted COVID at the workplace, not at my house and not, you know, while I was shopping. And so some jury should award me, you know, $1 million from this employer. So the employers are worried about the liability. There's also something else that's not being discussed. You receive, because of the federal government, $600 extra a week right now if you're on unemployment.
Right.
And in a lot of cases, that might mean they're receiving more money staying at home than if they go to work.
Yeah.
So we've given them an incentive, an economic incentive, to stay home. And so you've got all that stuff coupled. The president did something 2 days ago.
Did he try to force them to stay open or something?
Yes. So he used the Defense Production Act to say that the factories have to stay open. By the way, when I was hauling my cattle to the processor yesterday, I thought, if I get pulled over by a cop for speeding, I'm going to cite the Defense Production Act. I'm going to tell him that I'm going to a USDA facility, and the president has ordered it to be open.
That's right.
And I'm part of an important supply chain here. I don't know if it would have worked. He probably would have looked at me like I had three eyes and then zip-tied me and put me on the ground.
Yep.
Anyways, so the president is the reason he invoked the Defense Production Act, in my opinion, is so that he could absolve these factories of liability.
Okay.
You can't force the people to go to work.
Right.
But I think one of the reasons the factory shut down is they were worried about the liability. And this is a valid concern, the liability factor. Not just between the business and their employees, but between a business and their customers.
Yeah, I'm concerned about that. In fact, I talked to several Kentucky legislators last week, and they agreed with me, members of both parties, by the way, But the problem is they're not in session, and they were like, the chances Governor Beshear calls us back in session to do anything. And a couple of them were like, besides, we should probably do this on a federal level. Some states are doing it. Texas is trying to put some protections in place. But what can we do there to protect businesses?
Well, look, people sue McDonald's for the coffee being too hot, right? So they're going to, anybody that gets COVID that went to a McDonald's is going to sue the McDonald's, right?
Yeah.
Particularly if that's the only place they're eating for 3 months, right?
Right.
He's like, I know I got it there because it's the only place I ate for 3 months at the drive-thru.
Right.
Anyways.
Hence, we're fat and sweaty and walk over to the couch and just sit down. It's like the chickens.
That's right. It's recursive.
Yeah.
Here's my concern with what the president did. By the way, he's trying to address a problem. I've got a different solution, which we can get into here in a little bit. But let me tell you my concern with what he did. He's basically giving immunity to four giant meat processors. One is owned by the Chinese and one is owned by the Brazilians. So, ironically, he's telling American workers,
they have to go work for China.
If the Chinese factory you work for mistreats you, or you think they mistreated you, then just suck it up and let the Chinese factory.
And Chinese company has ever mistreated its workers.
Never.
Ever.
Right.
So, it never happened.
So that's a concern, but there does need to be some. I do believe there needs to be a safe harbor. Like if an employer or a business, a retail business, takes certain precautions in terms of distancing and masks and testing their employees every day, that, you know, there should be some level of care that absolves them from liability.
I agree. Okay. I think it has to be pretty specific. I don't like to shield people from liability
because
that's what allows big companies to abuse smaller people and businesses. But maybe something that's very specifically outlined that if you're following these procedures and somebody still gets it, because it's hard to figure out, like, where do you got it anyway? I mean, it's like there was this misleading story a few weeks ago about a woman who's like, the headline was, woman stays home 3 weeks, never leaves house, still gets COVID. And I was like, what? And I read it, and three paragraphs down near the bottom of the story, she had somebody who lived with her who was going in and out. And I'm like, they were deliberately trying to just, you know, hype up this thing so that everybody thinks they're all going to die. And it was journalistic malfeasance. But the point is, how do you know where you got it? You know, I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, we don't know what doorknobs people are licking out there. You know, you could get it from anywhere.
By the way, so here's what I think we should do if we're going to give some immunity to businesses or individuals.
Right.
It should be applied uniformly to all companies and all people.
Yeah.
You can't just single out these big meat packers. What about the smaller non-USDA meat packers, right? And what about the hairdresser that has a salon?
Dude, I'm getting my – well, I better not say anything because – I don't know.
Getting your hair cut.
I am.
I'm calling you out.
I don't know if it's legal or not. So next Tuesday, but I don't know if it's legal or not. So I'm not going to say anything else.
You didn't say what state you're getting it cut in.
I might have to go to a different state.
If you're in South Dakota, you should be fine.
I should be fine. Going incognito. Where are you going? I'm going to get a haircut four states over.
But if you go to South Dakota and return to Kentucky, make sure you quarantine yourself for 2 weeks.
That's what I'm saying. I got to keep my mouth shut. I feel like a gangster. I'm like, I'm on the down low getting my haircut.
Anyways, so it should apply uniformly to all companies, not just the big companies.
Right.
The mom and pop shops should get the same immunity that the big companies get. And here's the other thing. We have three branches of government. Judicial, executive, and legislative.
Right.
What the president's doing is saying that the judicial branch can't operate under the laws that were written by the legislative branch,
right?
Is outside of his jurisdiction.
Right.
And that's dangerous to liberty. What we should do is Congress should convene, and if there's going to be a law that changes tort, you know, across the country, but by the way, tort is usually a state issue. Mm-hmm. In fact, lawsuits, if those are all state issues, so this honestly should be done at the state level.
Right.
So So you mentioned that some states are getting together and doing that. And the problem with Kentucky is unless the governor calls them into session, they can't meet until like next January and pass bills.
Right.
But this is a legislative function. If there needs to be a remedy or a change in the laws, it should be done by people who are elected and represent smaller constituencies than just the entire state.
Yeah.
So that the diversity of the needs and concerns is represented in the laws if they're changed. It shouldn't be just one man changing all the laws for all the states. That's just messed up, and it won't work out in the long run.
I don't think Governor Andy Dad Jeans is interested in calling a special session. I talked to House Majority or Senate Majority Floor Leader Damon Thayer earlier this week, and he said that the governor, not once has the governor reached out to them to ask for help, advice, anything, not once. And I was like, I was pretty astounded by that because that's, and then I'll just say this. I know it from other sources that I was told that he also didn't reach out to, you know, like law enforcement and other people about some of the things that he was doing. So it's like, I don't think he's interested in doing anything other than just his 5 o'clock briefings every day and keeping everybody enthralled, you know?
Look, even like with the elections, he's announced that we're going to do mail-in ballots. How the hell does one person change the entire structure of an election?
Right.
What he should have done is called a meeting of the legislature.
Right.
And they could have debated this and come up with the law. So everything's a little bit on shaky ground when it comes from an executive, you know, edict,
right,
in my opinion, legally shaky ground. And what might start happening if the courts even meet is that he might be countermanded by the courts on some of these issues, and then that will increase his appetite for calling back the legislature. And this would be the same in other states as well, I would hope.
Let's hope so. All right, let's talk back about the meat shortage because you have a solution here.
Yes.
First of all, before we get into the solution, how long do you think this will last? Because as you mentioned earlier, there is a cycle of these things, and it's not forever. So, you know, are we looking at a 3 week meat shortage? Are we looking at a 3 month meat shortage? Are we looking at a 6 month meat shortage? How long do you think it's going to be?
Well, let me characterize the shortage. When you go to the grocery store, you'll be able to buy something. It just won't be what you went to the grocery store to buy.
Right.
You may want a pound of chicken wings and they sell you a pound of chuck roast.
Okay. Because it's what we got.
That's right. You'll feel like you're in Soviet Russia and they'll just be like, don't complain.
Yes. You know? Just, my wife had a one of the pastors of her church when she was young worked at the university that both of us went to, and he spent time teaching in Russia. And he told them in their class, he was like, his wife used to, the way that worked was he would go in the morning, every morning, Monday through Friday, he would get up and go to work. So he would get up and go teach whatever it was he was teaching in Russia. His wife would get up at the same time, and she would go to the grocery store, and she would stand in line all day and get whatever they had. And if it was bread one day, if it was meat one day, it's starting to feel like that, man.
So when we characterize shortages, I just want to be clear, there's different levels of shortages.
Sure.
There is the, we're, you know, going hungry shortage, and there is the, well, I guess we're eating, you know, chicken tonight and not beef shortage, right? The sort of shortages where you just don't have the variety you want, that's going to last a long time. Because think about what I said. They're causing sows to abort piglets right now.
Right.
And so that the trickle-down or the downstream effect of that is going to be a few months from now.
Right. So we're losing at least an entire generation. By generation, I mean life cycle of a pig.
Right.
We're losing that entire crop.
And then the dairy cattle, the cows that are being, that I witnessed yesterday being butchered. Now, a certain amount of that happens, you know, just because dairy cattle have a certain lifespan, right?
Right.
But I think more of that's happening now. So when you take down the dairy inventory of cows, you have to breed a cow, have 9 to 10 months gestation.
Jeez.
Then in order for a cow to have milk, so it's going to be born, it's going to be like 18 months before it gets bred. Then there's another 9 months until it has its first calf, at which point it produces milk.
Right.
So it's like to replace a dairy cow takes about 3 years.
Wow. Wow.
Now, yeah, think about that. So I don't know. I really haven't looked into how much the dairy herd inventory is going down. What might be happening domestically might not be happening worldwide. You know, the shortages might be replaced by importing.
Yeah. French beef
or or more likely African beef or South American beef.
Because of time cycles or whatever. Yeah. Okay.
Right. So
Southern Hemisphere.
And that'll be at the expense of the indigenous population of those countries, right?
Right.
They'll find it more profitable to eat less themselves and to send the meat over here, and then they'll buy something else
right
for themselves. So it's going to be, and by the way, we haven't seen the worst of it yet.
Right.
They haven't brought these factories back online, and it's going to last for a while.
Wow.
It will be through this summer.
So Americans are not going to starve.
No.
But we're going to get what we get.
You're going to get what you get.
You're not going to have the variety we're used to.
You know, you might be eating more red beans and rice.
Yeah.
Than you are grilling out.
Now I happen to get my meat from independent sources. I like farms like yours. I like to patronize as much as possible local suppliers. Does that supply continue uninterrupted in the sense that the life cycle is not interrupted, but then as people rush to them, they will then run out of stock eventually, right? But in terms of like I have one source of meat that is delivered to me monthly, and it's all grass-fed, so that's a separate supply chain, right? That's probably not going to get interrupted. The supplier I use actually is not taking new customers right now because they're so overwhelmed. But if you're within that group, which I am, I should be uninterrupted, right? Because they've okay.
It's a lot more robust. I don't know the processor they use to process the food that you buy.
Right.
But most of the processors that are geared to supply the type of customer that you are smaller in nature.
Right.
With my own cattle, I have used four different processors. One of them is a USDA facility. That's the one I visited yesterday.
Okay.
It's 3 hours from my house. And you can imagine the economies aren't really there when you drive two steers 3 hours.
Right.
And then you have to go back.
How much gas did that cost you? You got to drive a big truck with a trailer and heavy cattle in the back.
And then I've got to go back in a couple weeks and pick up frozen beef and get that back to my farm before it thaws. But I can sell that by individual cuts. And that's why I'm using that facility, because the U.S. duh requires it.
Right.
Now, the other three facilities I use are much closer to my house. In fact, one of them is 3 miles from my house. I can literally put my truck in neutral and coast 3/4 of the way to this meat processor from my farm.
Right.
My farm is like 200 feet in elevation above where this meat processor is. Don't ask me why I know that. But, and I have scheduled appointments for cattle there this summer. I'm going to take two in May.
But you can't sell that in a package, though.
I can't sell it in a package. And this is the problem.
Yeah, this brings us to your bill, the Prime Act.
That's right. So what we've done, Leland, over the past 50 years is what our country has done is we've consolidated 80 or 90% of all the meat processing into 4 companies and these giant factories. It used to be that there were thousands more local processors, and a farmer would bring, instead of taking his animals to an auction house where they would buy them and put them on a train and send them to Nebraska where they would feed them corn and then butcher them and then send them back, you know, another 1,000 miles back to his grocery store. Before we went to that system, farmers could take their cattle to a local locker. They would call them lockers or slaughterhouse or abattoir or processor. There's any number of names for them. And then you could buy locally there by the cut of meat. Well, the USDA now forbids that. And If you want to sell by the cut of meat, you have to be in a facility that has a full-time USDA employee sitting there.
So when I was a kid, there was a butcher down the street, and I could walk down there. Mom would be like, go get a pound of beef from, you know, Jerry. Mm-hmm. And I go down there and get a pound of beef or pork chops or whatever it was she wanted me to go get. Is that even possible anymore?
Well, I mean, you're doing it through the mail. And right. if you live near that USDA processor where I take my animals to,
right,
they have a retail outlet, and you can, but you got to win. It's like winning the geographic lottery.
Right, but that was an independent butcher. He used to have a freezer in the back with.
Well, here's the thing.
Hanging in there. And
here's the thing. Butchers, and this, it's interesting you bring this up. You could still go to a butcher, and right. the butcher could still cut up parts of an animal that had been slaughtered in a USDA facility.
Okay.
And the irony is, there's no USDA inspector at that butcher shop.
Right.
Like, and or at the restaurant. A restaurant can buy a carcass.
And cut it up.
And cut it up. But there's no USDA inspector there. And so these small mom-and-pop processors that can take a live animal and turn it into either a side of beef or hamburger or a steak or a roast, what the USDA is telling them is you need to hire one of our union inspectors.
Right.
And they need to be able to sit there the whole time you're operating. And they need to be able to shut down your operation at any point they don't feel good about what you're doing. And so here's what – so you have sort of this bifurcated meat processing industry.
Right.
Okay, Leland. On one side, you've got these giant mega facilities that have contracts with farmers. Okay. And on the other side, you have thousands of these small mom-and-pop meat processors. Okay, they may have a dozen employees, okay, and that would be it. So it's much more robust in terms of the probability that they're all going to get COVID-19
right.
is pretty low, because at least one of them has to get it, right?
Right?
Whereas in a big factory where there's 500 workers, it could spread like wildfire, and then they've all got it, and now you have to shut down a large amount of capacity.
Right.
Well, so back to the mom and pop shops, the small processors, they can do deer. This is where, like, if you shot a deer mm-hmm. and you wanted to process it, you would take it to one of these small processors.
Right.
Farmers can take cattle there. Farmers can sell beef to consumers using a loophole in the USDA rules right now. And this is how I know it's safe, because they're already doing it. And that loophole is, you, Leland Conway, are allowed to buy your own animal,
right?
And you can have your own animal butchered, and the government won't stop you from doing that.
Right.
And so what you would do is you would go to the farmer and say, you know, I want to buy half of this animal, and right. I'll share it with somebody else, and we'll have it butchered at this local slaughterhouse.
Right.
Now, to my knowledge, I don't know of anybody who's ever gotten sick eating half a cow.
Right.
So if you don't get sick eating half of that cow, you're not going to get sick eating one hamburger from that cow.
Right.
Okay. And that's my contention. So these local facilities, they are inspected. The health departments, you know, it varies by state what the rules are. And my bill would not change the state rules or absolve anybody from any state laws. But typically, these local processors are inspected by the health department, and they're subject to surprise inspections by the USDA.
Right.
What they don't have is they don't have a full-time USDA inspector, and they might have a 3-inch floor drain instead of a 4-inch floor drain.
Right.
Right. There's all these
right.
rules about even the size of the drain in the floor. And you can imagine, for a small processor, maybe they don't need a drain as big as the big processors, but the USDA requires you to have a certain size drain.
Right.
So what my bill says, it's called the Prime Act. And by the way, I picked up eight new co-sponsors this week.
Right.
I already had
Nothing
two
like
dozen.
A crisis to get people to actually do something.
They're starting to look at this bill, and I've been talking about it for 5 years. I think when you were back in Louisville, I was on your radio show talking about this at times, and talking about how brittle our supply chain was in the food system and why we needed to diversify and use smaller processors.
Right.
But what my bill does is it says, if the farmer and the processor and the consumer And there can be a grocery store involved too.
Right.
If they're all in the same state, in other words, if this animal doesn't cross state lines, then the USDA can't stop a consumer from buying a package of meat from a farmer using a grocery store and a local processor as the intermediary, even if the local processor doesn't have a full-time USDA inspector. That's what my bill does. And I thought about, see, what I don't want to do is I don't want to absolve these big corporations where you don't know where the animal came from, right? That are controlled by the Chinese, right? I don't want to absolve them of regulation.
Right.
So the first suggestion that was made to me was, well, why don't you limit it to number of animals processed per month? Like if the processor only processes 50 animals a month, then they could get this exemption. And I thought about that for a while, and I thought, that sounds like Obamacare. And
right.
Obamacare, what all it did was the small business exemption kept small businesses small.
Right.
And my goal is not to basically cap every small business at some arbitrary number.
Right.
So what I decided was, you know what? None of these giant corporations are ever going to agree to only sell within a state.
Right.
Right. They sell all over the world. They, in fact, they hate for the individual states to have their own labels.
Yeah,
they're always in Congress trying to get us to homogenize the labeling for the whole country. So that's where I drew the line. I said, let's make it a geographic boundary, and that way we know that you never have to leave your state if you want to go find the farm that raised the animal.
It also helps it has the inadvertent effect of helping the economy. I mean, right now we have Kentucky farmers. Because Kentucky is the eighth largest cattle producer in the country. We have Kentucky farmers that are going to be slaughtering cows and choosing not to, to birth new ones. And instead, so we're going to have a supply problem over here that could easily be fixed. And then we're going to have Kentuckians who are going to be buying chicken wings instead of chicken breasts or buying, something they don't like instead of beef. And you could marry those two things. It's called capitalism. One is a need, one is a supply. And you could have Kentuckians running around munching on Kentucky beef, raised on Kentucky limestone grass. So that helps Kentucky get through this. And if the USDA is so damn worried about it, they got a bunch of plants that are shut down, so their USDA union worker doesn't have anything to do right now. Put them in a government truck. And put them in that region and have them travel around and do surprise inspections at all those small plants.
Right. Or how about this idea? If they really insist on watching the whole process, put remote cameras
there
in
you
these
go.
Small facilities. Right?
There you go. If they can sit in a room and watch them.
If they've decided that one inspector can oversee 1,000 animals being slaughtered a day in one of these giant factories, right? Then why can't that same inspector sit in an air-conditioned room somewhere with 10 monitors? And watch 100 animals, 10 on through each monitor per day being slaughtered. They can even have a recording of it. If they don't, hey, what happened there? I was on my lunch break. Let me rewind and play that and fast forward. And, let's go back. Did they do that right? We could use technology to solve this problem.
Some twisted kind of new voyeurism. Ooh, I like the way you sliced your cow.
Oh, sorry. You're such a liability, Leland.
Like, okay, so this if it passes, this would how much alleviation to a potential meat shortage would this provide?
Great question. It wouldn't solve all the problem. Look, this is a problem that's been 50 years in the making.
Right.
It's like there's a river, and we used to have 100 bridges across the river, and we decided to send all the traffic across one bridge, and now it's crumbling. Well, we got rid of 90 of the bridges. There's only 10 other bridges to divert the traffic.
Right.
So this would be able to divert some of the traffic. Now, immediately, I think those small mom and pop shops would hire more people.
Right.
They would scale up. Each shop could probably double their throughput.
Right.
And there's over 1,000 of them. Okay. But more importantly, these are not... If you're not building an enormous factory, like the processor that I use, his shop is about half the size of my house, and I don't have a giant house. I'm just saying, it's like the it's no bigger than a reg, you know, than a garage, somebody's garage, a large, you know, garage. You can build one of these in a month, and you can get the equipment in there.
Right.
And so that is also why, Leland, and I'm glad you asked the question because it reminded me, this can't be a temporary fix.
Right.
You can't say, you know, like the president has done using the Defense Production Act, that we're going to temporarily give the big corporations immunity from liability. You can't do that. What you need to do is recognize that our food supply was brittle, that there are entrepreneurs who will respond, but only if they know that they have a valid business when this whole crisis is over with.
Right. Right.
I had somebody tell me, he had shut down his shop. He had owned one a few years ago. He said, in 5 weeks, I could be back up and running.
Wow.
And, you know, I think that's a reasonable number. People would be building these facilities or moving into, you don't have to build a building. There are lots of buildings that are appropriate. And they would move in and they would get going, but only if they knew they had a valid business when the crisis was over.
Right. And the problem is the big companies are lobbying against this because they'd rather us starve or eat stuff we don't want to eat than lose their grip on the profit margin when everything gets back to normal.
Yeah, not just the big companies. The USDA is also lobbying against it.
Right.
By the way, Leland, I talked to him about 2 weeks ago, the undersecretary for food safety. This person works for Sonny Perdue.
Okay.
She denied there was any problem.
Are you serious?
In fact, you can go back. They may be saying this today.
It's all over the news right now.
I know, but this was 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago. She said there is... She denied there's any problem, and she said that it's a demand problem, not a supply problem. And she was repeating what Sonny Perdue said. Now, that was a talking point they came up with when there were these milk shortages.
Right.
Because there was a problem with diverting the supply into the new demand channel. But on a conference call with my GOP colleagues yesterday, I suggested to them, I said, before anybody uses this phrase, it's a demand problem, not a supply problem, make sure you're happy with being tarred and feathered. I said that to about 180 other Republicans on a conference call.
Right.
Like, I advised them not to repeat that talking point, because I said, you're going to see food shortages, and people are going to remember that you said there's not a supply problem. I said there absolutely is a supply problem. Don't try to brush it under the rug. And this is another thing that I've been accused of. They say, Massey, you shouldn't be saying this because you will cause panic buying and there will be a shortage. Well, I'm in the government. I didn't run for government so that I could conceal facts from people.
Right.
I ran for office to be transparent, and I believe if you let people know what's really happening and the reason for why it's happening, they will make good decisions. It's like in the beginning, Leland, when the president said, we don't want everyone tested.
Right.
I was like, that's horse pucky.
Right.
What he was trying to convey was that we need to test certain people first while the tests are scarce.
Right.
And then I heard people say, masks only work if you're a medical
employee,
which is more horse pucky. I'm like, if it works for a doctor or a nurse, it's going to work for me.
Right.
Right. Like, I wear these things when I'm woodworking, when I'm cutting hay, right? Baling hay. It's very dusty. Like, I know how to put one of these masks on and get it to seal. You know, my kids painted a car in our barn once, an old Honda with a $15 sprayer from Harbor Freight. Like, we know how to use masks. Anyways, but they were what they were doing is they were changing their messaging to something that wasn't quite the truth because they didn't think the public could use the truth.
In their defense, they did see what we did to toilet paper.
But you know what?
That's why you guys will never tell us if the government has aliens. You will never tell us if the government has space aliens because of what we did to toilet paper.
But do you remember when people started hoarding toilet paper? And there were the memes making fun of people who were buying the toilet paper saying, you know, COVID doesn't even give you diarrhea.
Right, right.
Like, Why are you buying toilet paper in response to COVID? Well, they were never buying toilet paper in response to COVID. They were buying toilet paper because they could see what the government wouldn't tell them,
right?
Which is the factories would eventually shut down.
Yes.
And they could see that the government's reaction was going to cause them more pain and suffering and shortages
right.
than the COVID virus ever could.
Right.
And so they were responding to government overreaction, not to the COVID virus.
No, that's a good point. That's a good point. So what are the chances this bill passes?
Well, we picked up 8 co-sponsors in the last week.
Okay.
I had 24 co-sponsors, so we're well over 30 co-sponsors now, I think.
Both parties?
Both parties. I have 7 Democrats and 1 Independent in the House.
Nice.
And then the rest are Republicans. And then in the Senate, here's another measure of when you decide whether a bill has a chance or not. Is it just in one chamber and is there different language? No, it's in both chambers. In the Senate, Angus King is the lead sponsor of the Prime Act.
I remember you telling me that you chose him on purpose.
Yes.
Angus.
Rand was willing to lead this bill, but I was like, Rand, if Angus King will introduce the bill, you need to play second fiddle on this one because you just don't have your name can't compete with the Angus King. Certainly
the
not at
Prime Act.
Not at McDonald's. The Angus King is going to win every time. Angus King, and I'm very thankful. I know we're joking about his name, but I am very thankful that he's willing to lead this in the Senate. He's from Maine.
Yeah.
Okay. He's independent who caucuses with the Democrats, but he understands because he has a rural constituency
right.
the need for this bill. Rand Paul is a co-sponsor, and then Lamar Alexander from Tennessee is a co-sponsor.
Oh, good. Okay, cool.
So we've got all the bases covered in the Senate and in the House. People just need to call their representative and their 2 senators and say, have you sponsored the Prime Act? And if you haven't, what is your solution?
Right.
Because
great.
If you don't have a solution, you don't need to represent me.
Right. That's great. Yeah. So wherever people are listening to this podcast, anywhere in the country, call your senators and call your representatives and ask them that question. I think that's brilliant. Listen, we were only going to talk for about 15 or 20 minutes. We're at 56. I like it.
Are you paying me by the minute, Lee?
yeah. This nonprofit podcast. I hope that there's some sense talked into it. It drives me nuts. You know, I was just thinking about how slow government reacts to things, and that's part of the reason we're in this fix that we're in right now. I don't. Just before I let you go.
Yeah.
I think the hopes of a V-shaped recovery are gone now because of how long we've locked everything down. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with you on that completely. These bills that we convene and pass that are $2 trillion or $500 billion, I liken them to blood transfusions. The problem is we're putting blood into a patient that's bleeding. Their arteries have been severed.
Right.
And until you stop the bleeding, that's our economy. Our economy is the patient.
Right.
Until you stop the bleeding, you're just going to be doing one blood transfusion after another.
Yeah.
And by the way, maybe that's the way to pass this Prime Act. Maybe instead of, and I think every bill should only deal with one topic, but maybe we sneak it into the next omnibus spending bill.
Right. That's how we get it done. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Listen, it's great talking to you. Thanks for taking the time this morning, and thanks for taking the time to explain how this works. I think a lot of people are going, what do you mean meat shortage? I don't understand. And this really, and I don't want people to run out and buy all the ground beef at Kroger, but you know, if I were you, I'd probably get a couple of extra pounds for the next week or so until we see where this goes. But,
you know what I would advise?
What?
I would say drive down the road until you see some cattle in the field.
Right.
Everybody's driven by cattle. Get out and talk to the farmer.
Yeah.
And cut a deal. Cut a deal.
Yeah.
Say, look, I don't need the federal government to tell me that's a good animal to eat.
Right.
If you tell me it's a good animal to eat, that we're all good, and let's complete a transaction. So what I would say, instead of going out,
if you can't afford a whole one, get 4 friends and go do it.
That's
and
right.
Each of you buy a quarter of it.
That's right. Instead of running out and trying to buy what's left of the industrial food supply, start working on building relationship with your local farmers.
I like it. Yeah. That's much better.
And that'll be good for you after this crisis is over, too.
You'll help a farmer. You'll get healthier meat. It'll be closer to you, and you will have more meat than you can eat. So, awesome. Congressman Massey, thanks for your time today. It's the Prime Act. Call your representative. Call your senator. Get them on board with this. Thanks for your time, buddy.
Thanks, Leland.
All right. It's Congressman Thomas Massey on the Disruption Zone. Remember, you can follow us on, let's see, we are at Apple Podcasts. That's a free subscription. We are also at Google Play. And on iHeartRadio now, you can carry me and my awesome guests around in your pocket. Just go to iHeartRadio and search The Disruption Zone. I'm Leland Conway. Thanks for listening.